Hello and welcome back to Hacker Slacker. I'm Jacob Petticord.
And the Raptors are the NBA champions. We just finished watching the finals at my place, and it was a great game. We are big NBA fans in this household. So, by the way, I'm Andre Garive, and this is Hacker Slacker, and we've got a really great show coming up for you.
Episode 53, here we go. We can finally start recording before 9,
yes.
Now that the finals are over.
The NBA playoffs are over, and it's baseball season, which means nothing. So...
We are going to kick the show off with quite a bit of follow-up. First of all, Andre, I want to know, how is the beta going?
Okay, so I have the beta for iOS, iPadOS, and macOS. I'll start with macOS because it's what I use the least. It's not good. Everything breaks, approximately. So, basically, like, I can't use apps like Steam at all. They're just completely blocked on this operating system, because they need to be updated by the developer, according to Apple.
Like, they just won't open?
Yeah, like, it warned me before. Like, I knew it wasn't going to open, and I don't use Steam all that much, but it was like, yeah, you won't be able to use this. Just, you can't click on it, can't open it. So that was cool. GarageBand, if you noticed last week, at the very beginning, the music didn't fade in at the beginning, which is a nice thing I like to add at the beginning and end of every show is the theme song that we have. I like to fade it in and out, but unfortunately, I had to just throw it in an anchor because right now, GarageBand, when you import music, it goes at double speed. And we had a really fun time recording ads last week, too, with this issue, so our ads no longer have background music.
Yeah.
But... otherwise, I haven't really used it all that much. I've been using Safari about as much as Chrome just to try to see what it's like. I've been using a lot more Safari when it comes to iPad and iOS. I'll get to that in a little bit. But basically, I have had not a great time with Catalina, and I just think that's because it's buggy and certain things don't work super well. But iPadOS, on the other hand, I also don't use my iPad terribly much, but I will say from what I have used it for, taking some notes, the new Apple Pencil UI is actually really nice to have. You can move it around and it just works really nicely. I really enjoy having that. And also I've been using Safari because having desktop web applications is awesome.
Especially like Google Docs and everything like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed having that, but I definitely think I'll be utilizing it more once we get back to school in the fall. And then iOS 13. It's something I use daily. It's something that crashes a lot. It's something that makes Twitter and Snapchat freak out a bit, and my Wi-Fi is sometimes off and on. But overall, I've really been enjoying it. I finally went in and like customized my control center. Previously I had like one row of things in my control center, but now I have it filled up all the way and more set to what I use. It's really nice being able to search through Wi-Fi networks from control center, which is just another really nice thing. Safari is pretty good. I really enjoy dark mode. Apple Maps is significantly better. I've really enjoyed having the new Apple Maps. It's been something to think about a lot considering what I'm working on this summer, being Google Maps. But besides that, it's just kind of like a nice smooth experience. There is one thing I haven't really enjoyed, and if you have grouped notifications currently, I don't know if this is a bug or if it is their intended implementation, but if you have grouped notifications from the same app and you clear the most recent one, it will reorganize your notifications. So if you have like an app from new or a notification from news from 6 minutes ago and one from 2 hours ago and then a bunch of different notifications, if you clear the 6 minutes ago news, that 2 hours ago news one will jump to the bottom of your notifications list,
just like right in front of you.
Yeah,
that's weird.
I do not like it at all.
It's probably a bug.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I've definitely reported some bugs. I could go to my feedback app, and I've just had the weirdest time. Like, when you search through settings, if you type the letters R followed by E, the app just crashes every time. Same with RO. You can't swipe back pages in the podcast app. The news notifications in dark mode look really weird because they still have a white background when you preview the notification. I think we talked about it on the podcast previously, but in the widgets app, if it's a non-Apple app, if it's a third-party application, in dark mode, it doesn't show up as dark. Clearing notifications with force touch. Usually in other iOS or previous iOS versions, you can just, in one smooth motion, 3D touch on the notification and then swipe down and clear it. But currently, right now, you have to 3D touch, wait, it'll pop up, and then you can swipe it down, which it's just extra motion that I'm not a fan of.
Has the has your phone been stable, though? Like, has there been a lot of crashes?
It's crashed maybe... Application crashes happen a lot more than, like, OS-wide crashes. So Snapchat will crash a lot, Twitter will crash a lot, which unfortunately is the two apps I use the most. And I don't know if it's just because I use those the most that I notice it the most there, but it's only, like, restarted on me maybe once or twice.
Okay, yeah, that's not that bad. I remember, like, in previous years, I would always do what you're doing and, like, download the newest betas, and there were just some days where, like, you know, your phone crashes 3 or 4 times in a day, and it's like, how do I get this off? And you realize, oh, I can't get it off without losing my data. So it's just like,
and I mean, I was on, like, it was either iOS 11 or iOS 12 public beta, and it was doing that a lot.
So I'll probably be waiting for the public beta, but there's just a lot of stuff. Like, just before this, we did the AirPod sharing thing.
Yes.
And
that was pretty fun.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. So
each one has a custom volume slider, which was a really nice touch.
The levels, if you're watching, like, a movie with someone with AirPods, you can each set your individual volume, which is, I didn't think that was going to be a thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a lot of stuff I'll be excited to try out when the public beta comes, probably next month. But
absolutely.
I think more developer betas will be coming out in the next couple weeks. So.
Yes, I'm hoping they fix some stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that's honestly my favorite part about these early betas, is, like, seeing them actually improve upon the features that are broken. I really enjoy seeing that.
Yeah, you get to watch it live.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have a lot of follow-up news this week, just, like, follow-up on stories from the past. Back to the Galaxy Fold. We haven't heard about that in a while, and that's because the last time Samsung made an official statement about the Galaxy Fold is still April 22nd.
Because their devices were being destroyed.
Yeah, so because their devices were, you know, not bending correctly, and it's a bendable phone, and it was, you know, showing obvious signs of issues in reviews, we mentioned back on the show that they said that they'd be announcing, you know, the new pre-order date in a couple weeks. And that's still their last statement.
That was a month and a half ago.
A month and a half ago. So they are definitely not announcing the new release date. But the big news was that AT&T and Best Buy have both canceled pre-orders for the device. They're refunding customers. AT&T gave a $100 gift card for the inconvenience. So,
oh, man.
It is not looking good. I think that people are starting, like, these companies are starting to give up on the phone coming out.
Yeah, this is not a good look for Samsung.
Yeah, and at this point, if you're Samsung, like, you release phones so often, you might as well just catch them on the next one, right?
Yeah.
Like, the Note, whatever, was blowing up, and eventually they just released a new Note and everything was fine.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's gonna, you know, be too surprised if they just push it and release a similar product with a different name.
Yeah, nobody's like, hey, we're upset that you're not widely releasing this $2,000 phone.
Yeah.
Because it's broken. Like, nobody's mad at that.
Yeah, people kind of forgot about it, I feel like.
Honestly, I forgot about it. I didn't care about folding phones.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. But I don't know. Technology is ahead of itself. And it's a little bit of a blunder on the side of Samsung.
Well, on a cheery note, there is new phone tech news that I'm very excited about later in the show, but you'll have to wait for the news section for that one. So,
all right, I'm excited.
Our next piece of follow-up is about a upcoming streaming service that we've talked about called Quibi. This is something that we mentioned on the show. I haven't really heard get that much coverage anywhere else, but I'm pretty interested in it just because their whole thing was that it's people from the film industry starting a streaming service whose unique take is that everything is going to be like quick bites of content. That's what Quibi stands for, quick bites.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And so the idea is like episodes are about 10 minutes and they are getting like high quality directors. So some more details came out about it. Guillermo del Toro is going to be making a series for the platform. And Jason Blum, who was the director with Peele for Get Out and Us, and additionally BlacKkKlansman. So this is some, you know, Oscar nominated clout coming to the platform.
Yeah, it's Oscar winning clout.
And Oscar winning clout. So the idea is that these directors will be making 2 to 3 hour projects broken up into 10 minute episodes. They released the pricing information for the service. It's $4.99 a month for ads, ad free for $7.99 a month, which is, you know, pretty low, I feel like.
Yeah, that's
In terms of, so like something I did with the way HBO Now got me as a subscriber was I did my free trial for the season of Game of Thrones because I was like, okay, I need to watch it. Yeah. And then I decided like, oh, I'm 1 month over by my free trial, so I can watch the last episode. I might as well just pay for that 1 month. Yeah. And now I'm watching Silicon Valley. I watched Westworld. Like,
yeah.
Once they got me on it, it's like I've found content that I've liked and it's like, oh, I might just keep this subscription going, you know? Yeah. So I could see Quibi being something like, yeah, I'll pay $5 and watch this new Guillermo del Toro thing that everyone's talking about. And then, you know, if they have the content to back it up, they can keep that going.
It's like high quality YouTube video length content.
And when you're talking about the quality, the piece said that they're doing around like 15 million for some of these projects, which in terms of, you know, movies might not be crazy. Like it's no like Avengers budget, but in terms of something that is going to be in 10 minute segments, it'll be a quality that we haven't seen before. So I'm excited for it just because they're mixing it up a bit and it's interesting. Another player in the streaming.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've seen that area heat up a lot, especially recently. So the last note I have is that they're doing a weird thing where like the Guillermo del Toro guy, when he releases the show on Quibi, they have the rights to it for 5 years in these 10-minute segments. And then after their contract period, he can release it as like a movie is kind of the idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
yeah,
it's kind of weird. They said that they are going to be like, they were going with their gut for the first shows. And after this, they're going to be watching the data closely and see, like use the data for the next decisions. But yeah, that will be something that I'm looking forward to it coming out just to see how it plays into the whole, you know, streaming service landscape, if they can pick up any traction.
All right. So we also have a little bit of follow-up from WWDC. Getting something out on air.
This is a unique piece of follow-up in that it's really just stuff we missed last episode.
I don't know if you can tell what I'm doing, but I'm clicking a mouse.
Yeah.
And that is because another feature we completely forgot to talk about in iPadOS is mouse support. I am scrolling through my notes with a mouse on my iPad.
Yeah, so somehow we completely missed mouse support when we were going through that. The way we did our show, I thought it was fun. It wasn't necessarily, you know, cover everything exactly, but it's super cool that they finally added what people have been asking for years, which is mouse support. They did it in a different way than people were probably expecting. It's a accessibility setting, and obviously there had been accessibility devices on the iPad for a while.
Yeah.
But now they're supporting mice in a way that kind of shows like, hey, if this becomes popular, like we have the support for it. Like the fact that you can just connect your Bluetooth mouse to it and have a mouse cursor on your screen kind of shows that, you know, they're acknowledging it as a use case for the platform. Mm-hmm. One place where this comes extremely in handy is, you know, you have that USB-C port on the iPad. You can hook it up to any monitor that you could hook your MacBook up to. Well, now you don't have to touch the screen while you're using an external monitor. You can use a mouse, which is huge.
Yeah, I did. Gigantic. Like, people have always said, hey, the only way that an iPad can become a true notebook replacement is mouse support. Mm-hmm. And it's here.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at how a lot of people, especially developers, use their laptops, it's a lot of times it's plugged into a giant screen. So if the iPad is ever going to be that, if it's ever going to be a replacement for people who do, you know, serious work on big screens, you're never going to carry around like a 20-inch iPad. It needs to be able to hook up to external monitors, and you don't want to have to touch the iPad screen to use it on those monitors. So mouse support had to come, and I think it's actually crazy that it's finally here.
Yeah, it is really awesome. I love it.
And the way they did it is super cool because you can map all of the buttons to whatever you want. So like Andre's mouse, the MX Master, has like buttons on the side and like forward and back buttons. And so he can map those to like show the app switcher, go home, and even like run Siri shortcuts, which is crazy.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to have to check out that Siri shortcuts and maybe send a message to former guest Matthew Casanelli about some cool shortcut ideas.
Yeah, there were a ton of new things for shortcuts, and I didn't fully understand all of it, so we're definitely going to have to get him back on the pod to run us through some of the changes, because it sounds like some of the stuff is pretty big deals.
Absolutely.
Okay, so another peripheral update with iPadOS is support for Xbox One and PS4 controllers, which was actually one of the loudest people ever cheered during the WWDC keynote, announcing that you can use these on iPadOS and iPhones now. In the past, Apple had only supported devices that met their like proprietary standard.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're opening it up to just any Bluetooth controller opens it up for both these controllers. Yeah. Which is huge, especially with the App Arcade thing that they made, the subscription service that's supposed to allow you to play games across like your iPad, your Mac, your Apple TV. Mm-hmm. Being able to connect a PS4 controller to all those devices will go a long ways in terms of like letting you play real games.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Using controllers that everybody already has and loves.
And I mean, when you have as nice of a screen on a tablet, if you can use a PlayStation, if I can just take my PlayStation controller and play good games on this iPad, how much different is that from a Switch besides the titles?
Exactly, yeah. So if the controller support helps developers make more games and Apple doing this arcade push helps developers make more games, I think that could be a pretty substantial change in terms of, you know, how legitimate of a gaming platform the iPad can become.
Yeah.
One funny iPad gaming note is that one of the primary uses of my iPad in high school, the first high school I went to, had iPads as laptops. So like as a student, you're required to have an iPad. And one of the primary uses of my iPad, aside from Notability, my notes app, was playing Grand Theft Auto San Andreas on the iPad. I played that during school probably about as much as I took notes. So I beat the game on the iPad using the touchscreen.
Oh, but man.
That is a game that definitely could use a PS4 controller.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so we have yet more WWDC peripheral stuff that Woohoo. We didn't catch.
We just apparently forgot about all of this.
We forgot
week.
About plugging stuff in and connecting stuff to the iPad.
Yes.
So this last one is support for USB drives in the file system, which is huge. If you read any reviews of the last iPad, people loved it. You know, it's like, oh, what is missing for a laptop replacement? It was being able to connect mice and being able to connect USB drives. Well, now you can do both of those. So it doesn't have a dedicated keyboard, but other than that, it's pretty much everything you could want in terms of a laptop for most use cases. So, I mean, if you're a photographer, you can now plug your camera directly into the iPad to onboard your images, and then you could edit them right there in Photoshop, which... Okay, quick side note. We didn't hear anything about the full version of Photoshop for the iPad,
which
I think might be a bad sign, but we'll see. Maybe that's still coming later this year.
Yeah.
But anyways, being able to plug in USB drives and just letting it recognize like arbitrary devices, it feels like they were avoiding it for some reason. And now, like the mouse, they've kind of acknowledged that if we're really doing this, we got to do it. And this new direction they're taking the iPad in, you know, it's just... broadening the support for everything.
It seems like one of those things where it's like, oh, Steve Jobs has finally been dead for long enough for us to do this.
The people who were fighting them on the existence of files and the purity of the touch interface are no longer putting up that fight, it seems like.
Yeah, they're either dead or gone, so.
Yeah. Okay, so now on that note, moving into the news, the first piece of news comes out of Microsoft. There were some leaks about a new Surface device that is a tablet laptop hybrid with one display that folds. So essentially, it's the size of a tablet or a laptop screen, and you can fold it in half upwards, and then the bottom part of the fold becomes the keyboard, and the top part is the screen. And you can do things like put it into gaming mode, where the bottom part looks like an Xbox controller a little bit, flatten it all the way out, use it like a tablet, fold it like a book. It is... kind of a wild device. They have actually been rumored to be making something like this for a very long time. Like I remember it was called the Courier, and there were all sorts of like YouTube videos about how they're gonna make this like device the size of like a pocket notebook that you can fold out into a tablet.
Thing looks like an iPad Pro folded in half.
Yeah, and you can unfold it. They have this weird double hinge mechanism that makes it so you can use the screen like any way. So like when you think about like a Galaxy Fold, in the middle there's no hinge, it's just flat and it's kind of a piece of plastic that bends.
Yeah,
this, the screens actually like curve all the way like around,
wraps into the hinge
almost. Yeah, and then they touch each other with the displays, so mm-hmm. the screens can kind of go at any angle.
Yeah.
And it's not dependent on a piece of plastic that you're bending back and forth, because the screens are like distinct units.
Yeah. This is really neat. I hadn't seen this, but this could be a really awesome device.
It's definitely going to be, you know, continuing. The Surface is going to continue to push the limits of what these hybrid devices are.
Yeah, the hybrid productivity work devices, like the Surface Go was a big thing.
Right? Yeah. I mean, everything they've been doing with the Surface line has been a big step forward from what they were doing before.
For sure.
And this seems like something that is a big reach. Like, I don't think anybody's ever going to want to type on glass.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people talk about, oh, Apple put the touch bar in, you know, like they're making these keyboards so thin, they just want it to be glass eventually. I don't feel like that's ever going to catch on because, you know.
Unless you get some really good haptics.
Yeah, I mean, everybody who's, you know, there's a very big advantage to being able to feel where the keys are. Even people like us who've grown up using iOS devices still reach for real keyboards. You know, you mm-hmm. bought a Bluetooth keyboard for your iPad.
A Bluetooth keyboard right here. I'm not using it right now because I'm just reading notes, but...
Yeah. And I mean, if that Bluetooth keyboard was a glass display, it probably wouldn't really feel worth it. I don't know.
Yeah. One thing I really like about this is that also because of that hinge mechanism, there's a little bit of a strip of screen on the outside, even when it's folded closed, like you would fold close any laptop.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So like, you can like have notifications on the outside. Uh-huh. Like how awesome would it be if your laptop or whatever folded device you use had just a nice little strip of notifications? Like if the touch bar were on the outside of the MacBook and gave you... your notifications. I don't know. That seems like a kind of cool feature.
Either way, it looks funky. I mean, it looks like a bold move, which is something that I like to see, especially, you know, out of a company like Microsoft, who is kind of getting back into the innovating game.
Yeah. Speaking of bold moves and leaks, I was at work the other day and they're like, hey, the Pixel 4 was leaked. And I'm like, oh, God, no. And then they're like, by Google. And I was very confused. And so I went to Twitter. And Google just kind of tweeted a picture of the Pixel 4.
Yeah, so what people were saying is that there were all these, you know, the typical devices. Like, oh, someone got a reference model that was sent to case manufacturers. Blurry pictures of, you know, suspicious-looking hardware. And Google just said, you know, screw it, we're just gonna post some pictures of it ourselves, and you know, your blurry pictures won't mean much anymore after we've posted these, you know, high
quality
photos. I've
done so much digging trying to find a picture of that phone internally that I wasn't gonna tell anybody. I just wanted to see the phone, and then they just tweeted it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not a good thing when it comes to the fact that companies don't want these things to be leaked, and they're trying to stop how these devices are getting leaked. But at this point, it seems like any company is going to have people within their organization that are going to leak these things.
They said on the Twitter account that tweeted, it said, well, since there seems to be some interest, here you go.
Yeah.
Wait till you see what it can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was definitely you kind of forced our hand on this one, but we're just going to show you high quality pictures because we can now. And what they showed was just the back of the phone.
Yeah.
It showed this crazy like square camera unit.
Yeah. It's like a double camera with like a flash and a sensor.
Yeah. There's some funky stuff going on with that camera unit. And then other than that, I mean, it's just like a black slab of glass on the back with a G on it. I mean, it's nothing crazy in terms of like exciting stuff to... You know, they didn't show the front. They didn't show what they're doing with the notch situation.
Yeah.
So I think it definitely still leaves more to be desired. But, I mean, I think we all know the exciting part about the Pixel in the first place is the software. So.
Yes. All about the software.
And I'm excited, like, especially after everything they did with the 3A.
Yes.
Where it's just a hardware downgrade and they still release some cool software stuff.
Yes.
You know, what are they going to do with the new hardware?
Android Q is going to be... really good. I'm very excited for Android Q. The stuff I'm working on isn't specifically Android related, but I have been able to kind of see like how Android Q is being formed and like what they're thinking of, and I think it is going to be a really beneficial just a really beneficial OS in general, so long as adoption rate increases.
I guess one key takeaway is that the Pixel 4 doesn't fold. You can tell from the screenshots.
Yeah.
There's no hinge.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, so next up, a service that I never really thought would exist, Ubercopter.
I heard about this. They picked a bad day to announce this because this was the same day that helicopter crashed in New York City.
Yeah, I think it was an Uber helicopter that crashed too. So
was it an
Uber? It was Uber something like that.
All I know is that I saw that the pilot was not supposed to be in the air.
Okay, maybe it wasn't an Uber helicopter, but yeah, there was some sort of a crash in New York City, and starting this week, Uber, in the Uber app, if you're a platinum or diamond, the two highest level, if you're one of those two levels of Uber reward status, you can pay a lot of money to order a helicopter to fly between Lower Manhattan and JFK in New York.
That's ridiculous.
And you can order these trips up to 5 days in advance.
Oh man,
it's kind of crazy. But yeah, you can order helicopters through Uber now, so I mean they're going all the way to the upper ends of the high market.
Yeah, I mean, future of transportation, Mr. Khosrowshahi realizing a vision.
I mean, the craziest future of transportation stuff is the Uber Elevate. I don't know if you've seen information about that. Mm-mm. Essentially, they're talking about how they're working on these vehicles that'll be vertical takeoff and then also being able to go fast straight vehicles that they can deploy in cities, self-piloting to kind of be the real future of transportation.
I feel like they should probably first work on integrating themselves with public transportation,
but yeah,
that's a whole different story.
I mean, they were talking about it pretty confidently, and the idea is that in the sky, it's a lot easier to be self-driving, but vertical takeoff, you know, new flying vehicle sounds like a crazy moonshot idea. So,
self-driving cars.
Yeah, it would be cool to do a more in-depth look at that. So maybe we will sometime. But
we'll add that to the topics list that we barely touch, but that's a different story.
Yeah. Okay, so next, the delivery game is upped once again. Walmart is taking a shot at Amazon with their in-refrigerator delivery service.
This is too much. They've gone too far.
Yeah, so you might remember we announced that, or we mentioned on the pod that
we were the people who announced it.
Yeah, we covered when Amazon announced Amazon Key, a service that basically let you give Amazon a key to your front door, garage, or car, and they could do deliveries like kind of on the entrance to your front door, like just open the door, put it in, close it. And Walmart is taking it one step further by getting smart locks on your house, video cameras on the employees, and going into your house, putting groceries directly into your fridge, and then leaving.
I cannot with like every word possibility in my brain explain how awkward it is to not only let somebody just go in your fridge, but also to be the person who has to deliver groceries into somebody's fridge. I can't imagine how awkward that would be.
Well, Walmart says these people are going to be specially trained for the job, and they're also going to have cameras on them that provide a live video feed to the person they're delivering it to. So if you're at work, you can watch your delivery person put the food in your fridge to make sure they don't do anything fishy while they're in there.
Yeah, too much. It's too much. That's all I have to say.
It sounds like a Black Mirror episode waiting to happen is all I have to say. I mean,
I see you have a note here that Kansas City is one of their pilot cities.
Yeah, so they announced like three pilot cities and Kansas City's one of them. So I'm probably going to make my parents try this out sometime.
Yeah, that's... Yikes. Okay.
But yeah, one of the things they said that's coming in the fall, and then later this year, they'll let customers return Walmart items just by leaving them out on their counter. So you could be like, oh, this crock pot doesn't work, or it's not what I wanted. Just put it back in the box, set it on the counter, and then in the app you can be like, hey, come pick this up. I don't want it anymore.
Convenience and privacy are obviously trade-offs that you have to make, but And this happens with software, this happens with hardware, this happens with services, this happens with products. No. This makes me mad.
I don't know. It sounds kind of nice. If I had like a personal relationship with the delivery person and I trusted
that's understandable. Then
it would be convenient to just have, you know, food delivered into my fridge on a regular schedule, I guess.
Yeah.
But the economics of it just seem crazy to me in terms of like how much can they really charge for this delivery fee? How much do people really want to pay just to have it in their fridge?
Yeah. It's like Amazon Fresh will deliver groceries to your door. And if you think a good portion of Amazon and Walmart's market is city, people are living in a city, and maybe 40 to 60% of those people live in apartments. It's probably not a huge deal that it gets to your fridge. I mean, and you look here, my front door and my fridge are 20 feet apart from each other, albeit it's a small studio apartment, but still.
But what if you're delivering ice cream and you're at work? You know, they could put it right in the freezer.
Or I could just refreeze it. Or I could just schedule my groceries to be delivered when I'm here. Like, there's...
Very true.
They've gone too far, Jacob. They have.
And the other thing is, how could Amazon one-up this?
Yeah.
I mean, they can't deliver it straight to your mouth. What Grubhub is doing. Yeah. You know, like, if you wanted food delivered quicker than that, you would just use a meal delivery service.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon does this, but they do it instantly, where it's like you can have your groceries delivered to your house within an hour.
Yeah.
Like to your fridge.
Uh-huh.
I don't get it. I don't know where they're going to go from here, but they'll find something. Walmart has found their way into your fridge.
Yeah. I kind of at a loss for words.
Yeah.
I don't know how this can escalate anymore, but I'm guessing we'll find out. Yep. I don't know. Someone will think of it.
We'll report it.
Okay, we are now to the exciting smartphone hardware news you've all been waiting for. This week was the week of underscreen cameras. So, when you think about the legacy of the notch, for ages, we had bezels. And for a while, we accepted them. We said, these thick bezels at the top of my phone are okay. And then in the last couple of years, they said, no, we're going to push the screen as close to the edge as we can. We got rid of our home buttons.
Yes.
We got rid of as much stuff on the front as we could, but there's still one thing we couldn't get rid of, the front-facing camera.
The Snapchat camera.
So we've seen notches where there's kind of a little section that drops down from the top of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Samsung's doing the cutouts.
A hole punch cutout.
Yeah, it's just a little hole punch for the
camera. We've seen ones that pop up.
Yeah, we've seen
entire sliders.
Yeah, so there's been all sorts of hardware innovation to avoid the one simple fact that no one can put a camera behind a screen. But two Chinese companies demoed it this week. Oppo announced it first. They showed a video of it working. Essentially what happened was they were showing full screen photos on a phone, and then they went to pull up the selfie camera, and it went to the camera view, and a black notification bar was at the top of the screen where the camera is, and they were able to get picture from under the screen.
That's insane.
And then 4 hours later, so they must have beat Xiaomi to the punch on this, Xiaomi announced, they showed a little demo where they showed how the technology works. Essentially, it is a piece of display that's manufactured differently. So depending on the signal it's getting, it can be displaying the pixels or it can be translucent. And it allows the glass on your screen to double as the lens of the camera. So the idea is that with these notches and these hole punches, you know, they've been trying to get the cameras as small as possible to minimize the size of the notch, the size of the hole punch.
Yeah.
But now, because it can be behind the glass, the lens is as much of the glass as they want it to be. So they can go back to putting, you know, pushing the quality of the camera with greater size of the camera because you're no longer like minimizing that notch.
Interesting. That's very innovative. One of my favorite things that I've decided to do with my phone is the background that I use.
Yeah.
It just kind of highlights the notch a little, but in a way that doesn't make you think about the notch.
So your team hashtag embrace the notch.
I am until there's not a notch. Like, I'll be fine with it. But I've had a notch for a year and a half now, and I've had no issues. It's fine. That's it. I deal with a notch. I will until Apple gets rid of it, because I'm an ecosystem man, as much as I hate to say it. But I don't know, my iPad doesn't have a notch, so I'm not upset.
Yeah. Yeah, so this isn't something that we're seeing in phones yet. I mean, we'll all be watching to see who can pull it off in a retail device first, but yes, they've shown prototypes where this is working. People are saying you can make out like a slight difference in where the screen that turns transparent is versus where the normal screen is. That's probably just because they're using two different technologies to display the pixels. But maybe it'll be more refined in a final product. This is one of those things where it's really cool, and like the, you know, in-display fingerprint sensor, I want this in the next iPhone, but I know it's not going to be there because, you know, it has to be able to be delivered at scale and at, you know, pixel perfect quality, which isn't something that we're going to get for a while, but it is coming. Someone's proving that it's possible. I didn't know if it was ever going to happen, but I think it is a, you know, it was the last area of front phone screen innovation, you know.
Yeah.
First we had in-display fingerprint sensors. We got an upgrade with Samsung's Sonic in-display fingerprint sensor that was much faster. There was a company that was using the glass of the phone as an earpiece by vibrating it.
I remember that.
So we got rid of that on the front. And now if this last piece of tech can get rid of the camera, we can get our, you know,
full glass front.
Yep, and every phone can look exactly the same. You can just put a case on it, and no one will know what type of phone you're using because they will all just be a slab of glass.
Yep. It'll all be about the camera on the back.
Yep.
That'll be it. Last frontier.
All right, and the last piece of news we have is also a new piece of hardware. Not in a space that I've been covering a lot recently, but Microsoft at E3 announced the new line of Xboxes that'll be coming in late 2020. Yeah.
Do you have an 8K TV and thousands of dollars to spend extra and love gaming? Then you might be interested. Yeah.
So the new Xbox will have an SSD, which is something that's been standard in MacBooks for a while now. Be able to do 8K at 120 frames per second, which back from my gaming days, that kind of blows that out of the water.
Yeah.
And my gaming days were like, you know, a couple years ago, so that's not saying much.
I mean, I play my PlayStation.
Yeah, that's true.
Just about PS4, every day.
PS4, yeah.
Eh, I mean, it's fine.
I mean, you don't even have a 4K TV.
Exactly. Like, I have a 1080p HD TV because I bought it for $250.
And it's
bucks,
not like if they gave you 120 frames per second, your TV could do that either.
Exactly.
So, this is really ahead of the curve in terms of, I feel like, what most consumers have.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the way the gaming world is. You got to keep pushing the boundaries.
Yeah. This will make... I think it's also a help for pushes into professional esports.
True, yeah.
Having these just super high-quality devices, something that can stream at a very high rate, is really important when you want professional esports players. And Xbox wants to be the console that has the games that people are playing professionally.
Yep. So another piece of tech I noticed they were saying is included is ray tracing, which is something that's been in some high end like PC gaming cards. And the idea is that it's really cool. Like, it actually calculates like the lines light would take through reflections. So like better puddle reflections is kind of what it boils down to, and like atmospheric effects. Nothing that I've actually seen in person, but I've seen it talked a lot about. It's kind of the new hotness with like graphics cards. Mm-hmm. Might have to explain it more sometime if it ever actually becomes a big deal. But the big question that this gives me is, by the time this Xbox comes out, what will be the state of video game streaming? And will this be the last major Xbox hardware where the computation is done on the device and not in the cloud?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Stadia was, they gave that price out and the pre-order and everything. We'll get to see it this fall. Mm-hmm. We've got Apple Arcade coming, which is not necessarily streaming, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it become a streaming service.
Xbox has their own video Xbox game streaming service. Theirs. NVIDIA has theirs. PlayStation's doing theirs.
Yeah.
Everyone's getting in on this games in the cloud scene. But there hasn't really been, you know, large consumer success. Google seems like they're going to be in the position to try to make the first big push.
Yeah.
But people were saying, you know, these streaming services have been a big focus at E3, the big yearly gaming conference.
Yeah.
and people were saying using Microsoft streaming service, you know, in the conference center on not great Wi-Fi still had very little noticeable lag.
Yeah.
So I think the next Xbox we get will be less of like a beast piece of hardware and more of like a thin client Apple TV style thing that just talks to the cloud.
And I mean, it really helps that Xbox is a Microsoft entity because Microsoft has great cloud computing resources.
Yeah.
It really helps that Stadia is a Google entity because Google Cloud Platform works sometimes.
So what is Sony going to do?
Exactly.
With the PlayStation.
Well, AWS maybe? We'll have to see.
Yeah.
But on that note, we're getting a little bit into cloud computing, which is actually our main topic for today. You probably knew that because there's a title on this episode, but we will be right back after this break. All right, we are back, and we are going to talk about cloud computing real quick, because it is 10:10 p.m. right now.
Yeah, we ran a little long on the news, so this is going to be a quick main segment.
Yes, so we didn't really have an idea for today. We were going to do an interview that got pushed back to next week.
Yep.
It'll be really fun. We're really excited about this one. But for now, we're going to talk about cloud computing and some outages that have happened recently. So first, let's go over quickly what cloud computing is. And there are like three main platforms. There's Microsoft, there's Amazon, and there's Google, right? Cloud computing is essentially using a different company's computers and servers to host your own software. So a lot of websites that you see back in like the 90s, when the internet was very, very early, even up to like 2010, even up to recently, there are some places where when you host a website, you're hosting that on your own computer. Every time that it needs to run, it runs on your computer. And there are a lot of things that sometimes take a lot more computational power than your computer or a small company's servers can handle. So cloud computing kind of helps that in that these three companies have massive data centers that have servers for days, and they have redundancies all across the world, and essentially they can do very high level computing very quickly, and as long as you have a decent connection speed, you can just have all that computing done off-site.
And one of the main advantages of doing it off-site is if you're a purely software company, like Zillow, for example, Zillow uses AWS because they have software developers, not necessarily, you know, they don't want to have all of their employees spending time on systems administration, you know, setting up hardware, because that's actually like a pretty different skill set. Like me and Andre are software developers, and we're not going to be setting up or configuring server hardware.
I do not know how to do that.
And
I
mean, so
that's just not what we do.
Yeah, the advantages of it is if you're a company that makes software and you're not one of the major platforms that's so big they need to be concerned about this sort of thing, you can let your software developers be focused on purely the software and let these three companies kind of handle that side of the business for you. And so there's some interesting consequences of that.
Yes.
So if you're a company like in Lincoln, we have Huddle. Huddle, when they were first founded, was around when AWS was starting to grow. And so they used AWS to be able to reach scale with such a small team of software developers. But now that they're a fairly large company, they are kind of locked into the Amazon ecosystem. And what that means is, you know, Amazon can raise their prices, and Amazon employs developers too, so they know how much migrating away from their services would cost.
Yeah.
So they're able to kind of game their customers and say like, oh, well, if we raise the prices by this much, we know it'll still be cost effective for them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So they can, you know, slowly and slowly make these services cost more money. And so there's been... And also, like, let's say you're Walmart, you don't want to go on Amazon's platform because you're direct competitors.
Exactly.
And so they might partner with a company like Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you're a company that, you know, maybe you just don't want to be solely dependent on any of the three companies.
And we'll talk about this later.
And so there's platforms, that allow you to kind of deploy your service across different cloud providers.
Mm-hmm. So... today is Thursday the 13th. Yes, today is Thursday, June 13th, 2019. If you noticed today, perhaps that Spotify wasn't working or that Instagram wasn't working. That's because of cloud platform outages. So Instagram is obviously based on Facebook servers. Facebook doesn't exactly have a cloud platform, but they do run their own servers. And since they have so many software services, it is big enough to consider a substantial cloud platform. Like, there are billions of users dependent on it. So Instagram was down for a short bit of time today, and then so is Spotify, which relies on Google Cloud Platform, which also had an outage on June 2nd, I think. They had some network interruptions in the Northeast when they did some new configurations on their servers, and this is a bunch of technical talk to say that the world went down for about a day. You probably remember this, but a short list of things that went down are Nest, Snapchat, YouTube, Shopify, Discord, Vimeo, and Pokemon Go. So let's just talk through these things. My idea here is that we'll talk through these things and how they benefit from cloud platforms and how they got hurt by the fact that the cloud platform went down. So let's start with Nest. This is obviously a very important one. It's a Google entity, or an Alphabet entity, I guess. So Nest relies very heavily on cloud computing. Literally, their website goes down when Google Cloud goes down. But essentially, if you want your Nest doorbell to work, you're going to have to hope that Google Cloud Platform is up. And when it goes down, that's pretty consequential. You have home security going down. You have smart homes being able to, unable to be like unlocked. Maybe somebody left their key in their house because they're like, oh, I can just unlock it with my phone. And then they can't unlock it with their phone anymore.
And the trade-off is that a company like Nest was able to focus on creating their hardware and not, you know, the server hardware.
It, like, the hardware of Nest is very important, and I think it's more important that they make that hardware good, and then they can rely on these cloud platforms. And we will say these outages are rare, and oftentimes it's not the scale of the one we're talking about, but they are consequential. Snapchat, obviously, they want you to be able to send snaps to people. They want you to be able to look at stories. They want to be able to serve you ads. They need to make money. And they rely on Google Cloud Platform. So obviously that's a huge hit to them. And their user base tends to flock to Twitter. From what I found is, when something goes down, like Instagram today, I saw it was down, I went to Twitter. Spotify today was down, I went to Twitter. Because if Twitter's not down, that's where most people will talk about these outages. And also, I don't know what cloud platform Twitter is on. Do they have their own servers?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. But Twitter is not down as much as other things. So it's helpful to figure out what's down. Next is YouTube. Obviously, you get the point. YouTube very much relies on it. Shopify in the same way. Discord and Vimeo, also very similar. Pokemon Go is a little different because it is an application that you kind of you have to go out and about for.
And it's a big thing where these cloud companies are like trying to offer more and more specialized services. So, you know, at first it was just like, here's a computer in the cloud. You don't have to like make your own computers. And then it was like, oh, we're Amazon. We're going to offer, you know, a search service so that you can search through the information you have stored on the cloud. Yeah. You don't have to write your own search.
The amount of cloud APIs are incredible.
Yeah. So now it's getting all the way down to the thing where like talked about how Microsoft announced APIs for storing AR objects in real world space. So like a platform like Pokemon Go could say, oh, we just want to focus on the game and designing our Pokemon. We don't want to focus on writing the software to like, you know, maintain where all the Pokemon are. Yeah. They could outsource it to Google, like a cloud platform, and whatever platform they chose that has that special feature, now they're locked in.
Yeah.
So like now AWS has locked that company in because they were able to create a feature that the competition doesn't have.
Yeah.
So there's a huge race like that. And you see like if one company makes a feature within the next month, all the other companies have it, because it's kind of just an arms race in terms of like who can get developers locked in into their ecosystem.
There's actually a whole new building, new Google building in South Lake Union that is going to be hosting the cloud team. That's currently in my office. So cloud is very important. And another thing is there's a difference here between what's called software as a service and what's called platform as a service. So software as a service is essentially a cloud computing company packaging an entire software like G Suite or Office Online or 365 and packaging those productivity software suites together, giving them to you. But all of that is processed on their own servers, whereas platform as a service allows software to developers to code away, make these gigantic applications, make web apps, make systems without having to depend on their own hardware firepower.
Yeah, I mean, if you remember one thing about what the cloud means, it's kind of just the taking of servers from the company being in charge of it to these cloud providers being in charge of it. Which might sound kind of simple, but you know, back in the day, it was kind of taken for granted that, you know, if I want to put up a website, then I have to have some piece of hardware in my house or in my office that is serving that to everybody all across the world, which is not very efficient, you know. And if all of a sudden I get, you know, 200,000 visitors on my site, well, it's going to go down because I can't handle that load. Versus if I'm on AWS, they can scale it up to, you know, accommodate any scale because they're Amazon.
Literally any scale. So essentially the cloud computing is just something we wanted to talk about because we knew this was going to be a shorter main topic, but this is something we've kind of wanted to talk about before. We don't really know how to fit it in. This is a bit shorter one. I don't have anything else to say about cloud computing. It's pretty simple, but it's kind of nice to have an explanation out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely talked about in the news all the time, so hopefully you have a slightly better understanding of how it works now.
Yeah. You got anything else?
That's all I got.
All right. So you can contact us on Twitter at HackersPod. Send us an email at hackerslackerpod@gmail.com, or now you can send us a voice message on Anchor, in the app, on the web client, whatever. We would love to hear from you guys. Once again, that's voice messages on Anchor, hackerslackerpod@gmail.com, or at HackersPod on Twitter, and we will see you next week.
Bye.